The Selected Shorts podcast is sponsored by Audible.com, home to over 75,000 audiobooks and more, including the Thalia Book Club and Selected Shorts series. Learn how to download a free audiobook at audible.com/symphonyspace.
From PRI, Public Radio International.
All these people had to struggle through so much adversity. And it had to do with when you were born and where you lived. I can't imagine it. It's easy to forget how lucky we are, I said. Where do you think our sadness comes from? Cornelius said. From owning too many things? From indigestion?
You're listening to an excerpt from The Modern Age by Francis Huang, being read by Dawn Akemi Saito. We'll be hearing this tale later on this broadcast of Selected Shorts, a celebration of the short story. I'm Isaiah Sheffer. In 2007, the McDowell Colony in the Monadnock region of New Hampshire was celebrating its centennial, 100 years of providing a comfortable creative environment for writers, composers, visual artists, and filmmakers. And one of its celebratory occasions was an evening at Selected Shorts, at which writers who've been fellows at McDowell introduce stories by other writers they admire. We'll hear two of these stories. First, The Proposition by David Besmozgis, a Canadian writer who left his native Latvia during the exodus of the Soviet Jews. The immigrant characters in his story struggle to make their way in their new land. The Proposition, read by Paul Hecht, was introduced on stage by the Pulitzer Prize-winning writer Jeffrey Eugenides.
You've heard the rumors about artists and art colonies. I'm here tonight to set the record straight and confirm them. The woods around McDowell abound with wildlife, the singing thrush, the leaping deer, the married composer climbing out a back window, the installation artist tiptoeing down a 2 a.m. hallway, holding her shoes in her hands. Art colonies are always putting on the same play. It's a Midsummer Night's Dream all year long. I went up to McDowell a year after my first book was published, when I was writing the first trembling pages of my second. The combination of rustic seclusion, bohemian bonhomie, and ardent industry seemed perfect to me. It's no wonder, then, that I'm here tonight to sing the praises of the McDowell Colony and to praise a young writer who set up camp there not long ago. David Besmozgis was born in 1973 in Latvia. He immigrated with his family to Canada in 1980 and makes his home there today. Something of Besmozgis's native language remains in his prose, flavoring his cadences. A ghost world haunts his sentences, imparting to his work a dignity and restraint that have largely vanished from the needy, wisecracking contemporary American short story. It isn't just Russian that haunts Besmozgis's prose, but Russian-ness. Nostalgia, from the Greek, means the pain of return. But nobody thinks of it that way, because nostalgia feels nice. The Proposition is a story about nostalgia, not nostalgia for the good old times, but that other nostalgia that sneaks up on you in middle age. Nostalgia for the bad old times. I'm pleased to introduce tonight the work of a recent McDowell colonist of no uncertain talent. The Proposition by David Besmozgis, which will be read by Paul Hecht. Thank you.
Roman Berman looked again at his rectangular desk clock, a complimentary gift that had come with the first Time magazine subscription. The subscription ran him $60 a year, but he justified it as a necessary expense. Even though he planned his schedule meticulously and rarely kept a patient waiting, the magazines lent his office a sense of professionalism. Though he preferred the newspaper, he sometimes perused the magazines himself, particularly if there was a profile of an athlete or a businessman. Other times, if he came across something that he thought would be of interest to his son, he brought the magazine home. Recently, there had been an article about a famous Hollywood movie director, the son of Hungarian Jews. The director had immigrated with his parents to America when he was a boy of six, like his own son. He had then gone on to attain tremendous success. The article described him as a millionaire many times over. Roman wondered if his son had read it. He'd brought it home the previous week. He made a mental note to ask his son when he got home, not to pressure him, of course, only to inquire. It was 5:10, and Svirsky was now more than half an hour late. Roman had specifically told Svirsky to come to the office at 4:30 after his last patient of the day, but at 4:30 there had been no sign of Svirsky. Roman had been surprised. If he had been in Svirsky's position, not only would he have been on time, he would have been early. But apparently Svirsky didn't think this way. Roman waited and tried to sort his files, but he found it nearly impossible to focus and frequently consulted the clock. He himself always tried to be punctual. On the rare occasion when he was delayed, he made sure to call and inform his appointment. Svirsky hadn't called. It infuriated Roman, especially since he was the one doing Svirsky the favor. Earlier in the week, Roman had gotten a call from Leonia Rybak, Svirsky's brother-in-law. At first, Roman thought Leonia was calling about the status of his insurance claim, but Leonia didn't mention the claim. He asked about Roman's Volvo. "I was going to put an ad in the paper," Roman said. "How does it run?" Leonia asked. "Very well. It leaks a little oil, but I top it up once a week. Renata's brother just came here from Leningrad." "Oh, she must be happy." "She can be happy. The problems come down on my head." "He needs a car?" "He has a car. Against my advice, he bought a Ford Tempo. Used, a piece of garbage. Some mornings it starts, some mornings it doesn't start. You could flip a coin. He has 2 kids, 1 and 7. The wife is at home with the baby. I found him a job at a scrapyard, but without a car, he can't get to work." Roman had been sympathetic. After all, it wasn't that long since he had been in Svirsky's shoes. Nobody needed to remind him how little separated him from Svirsky. An outsider might see his office and presume that everything had fallen into place, but Roman knew better. He lived from phone call to phone call. Come the holidays, he made the rounds of doctors' offices, bringing a bottle of cognac or a box of chocolates, doing what he could to ensure that they didn't forget about him and kept referring their patients. The receptionists weren't always happy to see him. Some ignored him and made him wait. "Hi, Shirley. Hi, Wanda. Happy Hanukkah, Raquel." It was no great joy to go simpering around like that, but he was prepared to do it if it paid the overhead, the mortgage, and what they charged for Hebrew school. Every now and then, when a big jackpot was announced, he bought a lottery ticket, but he didn't hold out any hopes of becoming rich. He was a man who had come to a new country in his 40s with few marketable skills, equipped with no English apart from 2 novelty phrases. "Life is very complicated," and "keep in touch." In his more sanguine moments, Roman thought, "Anything I've attained, I should feel fortunate." In light of this, he'd consented to help Leonia. He assured him that his brother-in-law would get a decent car at a fair price. True, Roman thought, you invited trouble whenever you did business with friends. The Volvo could break down tomorrow, and then there would be bad feelings. With a stranger, you could wash your hands of the thing, but with a friend, you assumed responsibilities. Nevertheless, he agreed to do it. He even refrained from putting the ad in the newspaper. But now, for all his good intentions, he was sitting around like a fool. Roman considered waiting another 10 minutes until 5:30 before going home. It wasn't often that he was able to get home so early. Usually he had appointments until after 6. He didn't get in until 7 or later, but by then his wife and son would have already eaten dinner. The boy might be doing homework, reading, or watching television. Roman would eat alone and maybe spend a few minutes with his son between television shows before the boy went to sleep. He wanted to stay involved in his son's life, to be a good father to him, but it was a difficult age. The boy was often moody and irritable and made Roman feel as if he disapproved of him, as if Roman was always putting an emphasis on all the wrong things. Roman resolved to go, but at that moment he heard the jangling of the bell on his front door. Now, finally, here was this Svirsky, Roman thought. He'd accumulated so much resentment waiting for him that he felt tempted to turn him away and teach him a lesson. Well, that he wouldn't do, but he would certainly vent his displeasure. The mere thought of venting his displeasure made Roman feel better. He was eager for Svirsky to come through the door and into the inner room where Roman had his file cabinets and his desk. In here, Roman called. But it wasn't Svirsky who came through the door. When he saw who it was, Roman cursed both himself and Svirsky. He should have left earlier. He knew it. He had tried to do someone a good turn, and now, inevitably, he was being punished. We were passing by and thought we'd stop in to see if you were busy, Kopman said. With him was his partner, Gruber, the Israeli. Gruber followed after Kopman and then stepped aside to make room for an attractive young woman. She had straight brown hair down to her shoulders and wore pink lipstick and pale whitish eye makeup. She was tall for a woman. In heels, she was level with Kopman. She was also slim, but in a tight blouse and short skirt, everything she had was exhibited to maximum effect. Since he rarely had occasion to meet with more than one person at a time, Roman had only 2 chairs on the opposite side of his desk. It looks like we caught you at a good time, Kopman said before sitting in one of the chairs. I was waiting for someone. He's late. I was about to leave. Good, then, Kopman said. We'll only be a minute. Kopman motioned for the woman to sit in the second vacant chair. He spoke to her in English. Sit, Felicia, dear. The woman did as she was told and sat almost directly across from Roman. She gazed at the wall at a spot vaguely above Roman's right shoulder. There he had his framed diploma from the board of directors of Masseurs, a recent school picture of his son, and an arts and crafts project the boy had done years ago in summer camp, a pattern of nails strung with green yarn that spelled out the Hebrew word shalom. Well, Kopman said, we just wanted to know if you'd given more thought to our proposition. Roman looked from Kopman to Gruber, who stood behind him and made no effort to mask his feelings about their proposition. He didn't like either of them. Gruber was antsy and unhealthy. He was obese and careless about his personal appearance. He had a thick growth of stubble, and his kinky hair bulged like stuffing from the baseball cap which he'd neglected to remove. Kopman, Roman's wife, had known as a girl in Rezekne. They had been in the same class. After he graduated from high school, his family left for Israel. All kinds of stories circulated about what he'd gotten himself involved in over there. His wife hadn't even heard that he'd come to Toronto until he'd shown up unexpectedly at Roman's office. The first time, just the two of them had come, Kopman and Gruber. They'd arrived in the evening while Roman was with a patient. When the door rang, Roman had stepped into the waiting room to investigate, since he had no more patients scheduled and wasn't expecting anyone. Kopman had introduced himself, mentioned his old acquaintance with Roman's wife, and said that he was there with a business proposition. What proposition? Why arrive unannounced? Kopman didn't explain. Roman hadn't liked the look of the two of them from the beginning, and he had a hard time concentrating on finishing the session with his patient. And when the patient left, Roman had had no choice but to allow Kopman and Gruber to outline their proposition. The proposition amounted to this. They were pimps, and they wanted to make him into a pimp, too. There was good money to be made in massage parlors, Kopman said. All they needed was someone with a valid masseur's license. Other than supplying his license, Roman wouldn't have to do anything. They would take care of everything. They would set up the business and manage it. Once a month, Roman would receive a check with a percentage of the profits. He wouldn't have to so much as lift a finger. If the first parlor proved successful, they could expand. And if the police come, Roman asked. If the police come, we try to arrive at an arrangement, Kopman. And if they don't accept your arrangement, then they will just close the place down, Kopman. And report me and revoke my license, Roman said. You might get a warning, that's all, Kopman said. You know how many places like this there are in the city? Enough, Roman said. So why shouldn't you benefit also? Do you deserve any less? I'm sure it wasn't easy to write the exams and get the license, Kopman said. If it was easy, I wouldn't be here. I'd do it myself. Roman had told them he wasn't interested. They had suggested he reconsider. Why rush to refuse? Kopman asked. There's real money to be made. Take some time. Think about it. It's a good opportunity. In the days that followed, Roman had repeated the conversation to his brother-in-law and to a few select friends. All had been of the opinion that he should explore further. They had heard of such enterprises. It was no lie. People made money. Besides, what was so horrible about a massage parlor? If Roman decided to go ahead with it, nobody would condemn him. Despite what they said, Roman had misgivings. Kopman was right. Passing the exam hadn't been easy. He had devoted himself to it for more than a year. After a day of warehouse work, he had come home to study. In all his life, he had never worked so hard. All the while, he had been sustained by dreams of opening his own practice, being his own boss, providing for his family in a dignified way. He lived that year in a state of perpetual anxiety. He was tyrannized by the fear that he would fail the exam and be consigned forever to a life of warehouse labor. No matter how long and grueling the hours of study, they paled against the wretched prospect of failure. When he received the letter informing him that he had passed, he was jubilant. He felt that he had accomplished something monumental. He would work in a clean office, almost like a doctor, and his son wouldn't have to be ashamed of him. He'd spent 7 years building a good reputation. He had devoted clients who ascribed to him their miraculous recoveries. An old man who couldn't get out of bed now walked to buy his groceries. An accountant who couldn't tie his shoes now played tennis. An arthritic grandmother who couldn't turn a doorknob now planted roses and baked cookies. He dealt honestly with people. He never cheated anyone. Whatever he did was within the law, or if it exceeded, it wasn't in any odious way. He did what everybody did to stay in business. If somebody had a benefits plan that covered massage, he'd provide a document attesting to treatment and then split the proceeds. If somebody got into a car accident, he would diagnose an injury to assist with the insurance claim. It was because of this that Leonia Rybak, for instance, stood to collect $2,400. There was nothing contemptible about that. Benefits money, if left unused, disappeared. And each year, the insurance companies, renowned crooks, made billions in profits. But to become involved with people like Kopman and Gruber and to risk his reputation for a brothel? Something entirely different. The worst kind of trouble could happen in such a place. There could be drugs, fights, even murder. If anything happened, he could be implicated, sent to prison. He imagined the scandal, the humiliation. How could he face his wife and his son? And even if nothing happened, what if his son discovered that he'd become a partner in a brothel? How would he explain such a sordid thing? More money? This was no explanation. They weren't starving. Without a massage parlor, he and his wife had jobs and were doing okay. He would rather struggle and live modestly than gamble and lead that kind of life. He'd already experienced that kind of life. His father had lived that way. When they settled in Riga after the evacuation, his father had traded on the black market. He had speculated in gold, gemstones, textiles, and heirlooms. Officially, his job was as fire marshal at a theater. But he was there only during performances, a few evenings a week. The rest of the time, he had free to pursue deals. They were a family of five, Roman, his parents, and his two sisters. His mother stayed home and looked after the house. The situation after the war was grim. Sections of the city were rubble and there were shortages of everything. His father bore a heavy burden. He was a small, austere man, frugal in his affections, but Roman revered him. Roman was 12, 13, 14 at the time, the same age as his own son now. He hadn't known every detail, but he'd known enough about how his father made his living. Once, his father had awakened him in the middle of the night, took him into the cellar, and showed him where he had hidden a box containing gold coins and banknotes. "In case something happens," his father had said. Roman understood that if the authorities ever caught him, his father would be severely punished. Almost certainly he would be sent far away where anything could befall him. He worried also about the people with whom his father associated and the harm they might do to him. Nights, when his father was late coming home, Roman didn't sleep. He snuck outside and stood in the shadowy passageway that led from their building's courtyard to Red Army Street. There he stood and peered into the night until he saw his father's familiar form walking resolutely home. The sight always made him dumb with relief, gratitude, and love. Though when his father saw him, he became furious and berated him for lurking about and drawing attention. But no matter how many times his father berated him, Roman couldn't help it. He couldn't sleep or keep still. He had to go out to the street because every second of not knowing was unbearable. And once he saw his father, the abuse didn't matter because his father was home. Roman did not want to subject his son to this kind of life. To Kopman, he said, "I thought about it, I talked to people, but I haven't changed my opinion. It's not for me. I'm not interested." "It's really a shame you feel that way," Kopman said. "Personally, I think you have the wrong idea about what we are suggesting." "What wrong idea? I understand everything perfectly well. Have you ever visited such a place?" "What the hell for?" Roman said. "Some of the places are dirty. Maybe you think we would be running a dirty place." "Kopman," Roman said, "I don't care what kind of place you plan to run." "The place will be nice," Gruber said in English. "We would only make a nice place." "This is why we brought Felicia," Kopman said, "so that you could see for yourself the kind of girl we would hire." At the mention of her name, Felicia glanced opaquely from Kopman to Roman. "Stand up, Felicia dear," Kopman said. "Let Roman take a look at you." Obediently, Felicia pulled her chair back and rose. She didn't make any lewd poses or change the expression on her face. She stood up with her hands at her sides and rested her weight slightly on one hip. "You see what a beautiful girl," Kopman said. "Guess how old." "What are you doing, Kopman?" Roman said. 23, Kopman said. "She isn't just some whore off the street. She's very intelligent. You can talk to her. Ask her where she's from," Kopman said. "It makes no difference to me where she's from," Roman said. "She's Czech." "From Prague," Kopman said. "Where are you from, Felicia?" Speaking in a bored, faraway voice, the girl said, "I'm from Prague." Kopman raised his eyebrows and smiled triumphantly, as if he had proved a disputed point. "She's also educated," Kopman said. "She has a medical background. In Czechoslovakia, she studied to be a nurse. She knows massage. She's not a professional, like you, of course, but she's very good." "Fine. Is that all? Are you finished?" Roman said. "You don't believe me, Kopman? Take her into the other room. Tell her what you like. She'll do anything you say." "Kopman," Roman said, "what is wrong with you? You grew up with my wife. You went to school together." "Yes, so she was a good student. She helped me with my homework. What does one thing have to do with the other?" "Get out of my office. Get out," Roman said. "Don't be rash," Kopman said. Roman turned his attention to the girl. She looked like a normal girl. She was no different from anyone you saw on the street. He wondered how she had become like this, how she had gotten mixed up with scum like Kopman and Gruber. "Young lady," Roman said. She lowered her eyes and looked at him slightly confused, as if uncertain that he had addressed her. "Young lady," Roman said, "I read in the newspaper that there are not enough nurses. You studied to be a nurse. Go away from these guys. Hospitals are looking for nurses. Go be a nurse." A hard, unpleasant look crossed the girl's face. "F*** you," she said. With that, they left. What a miserable day, Roman thought as he drove home. It was already 6 o'clock. After Kopman, Gruber, and the girl had left, he'd taken several minutes to compose himself. He was plagued by a bad feeling, like he had been soiled. He also found it hard to banish the image of the girl's cruel face. He'd meant only to be kind, and her viciousness had taken him completely by surprise. He felt her insult keenly, like a slap. He steered the Volvo up Bathurst to Finch, turned on Torresdale and into his subdivision. 6 o'clock and not a word from that bastard Svirsky, Roman thought. A miserable day. Roman parked the car in the driveway and climbed the cement steps of his porch. When he unlocked the front door, he sensed something odd. It took him a moment to register what it was. He saw a pair of strange boots in the entryway, worn and scuffed, and then he heard his wife's voice coming from the kitchen, speaking politely, even formally, and after this he heard a man's voice thanking her, declining something in a muted, timid way. Roman didn't call out to announce his arrival, but went up to the kitchen, where he saw a man seated at the table, his back to him. The man was still wearing his jacket. Seated across from him was Roman's wife. A teapot, cups, fruits, and biscuits were on the table. Beyond the kitchen in the living room, the television was on, and his son was lying on the sofa. "There you are, Roma," his wife said when he entered. This caused the man to turn in his chair to face him. Introductions were unnecessary, but his wife identified him as Edik Svirsky. Svirsky looked to be in his middle 30s with a haggard, though handsome face. His eyes were gentle, brown, and filled, as the saying went, with all the sorrow of the Jewish people. His hair, like a boy's, peaked in the middle. He was thin, but his hands, which fidgeted nervously, were large and strong, the nails dirty from the scrapyard. "We just called you at the office, but you'd already gone," his wife said. She shifted a cup and saucer and bid Roman to sit down. Roman didn't sit, but said, "Of course I'd gone. I've been waiting since 4:30. He stared at Svirsky, expecting an explanation. The scrutiny made Svirsky fidget even more. "His car broke down," his wife said. "I'm very sorry," Svirsky said. "I wanted to call, but I couldn't find your number. I was at work. They'd agreed to let me leave early, but the car wouldn't start. Guys from work tried to fix it, and then they called a tow truck. My English isn't very good, and I didn't understand everything that was happening. The tow truck driver took the car to the garage, but I didn't want him to. I imagined it would cost a lot to repair. I asked the driver to take it to the parking spot at my building. It was already late then. I called Leonia, and he told me to just walk to your house. I hurried, but it took 20 minutes. In the living room, the television erupted in loud, idiotic laughter. It put Roman's nerves on edge, and he shouted for his son to turn it down. "Sit," his wife said. Roman squeezed in and sat. His wife then called for their son to get up from the sofa and join them in the kitchen. "Your father came home," his wife said. "Come over and say hello." His son turned off the television. He rose from the sofa as if it were a great chore. Roman watched him come. When his son had been younger, he'd been athletic. They had enrolled him in soccer in the summer and hockey in the winter. He hadn't been an exceptional player, but he had enjoyed it, and Roman had enjoyed attending the games. In his own youth, he'd been something of an athlete, and he'd liked having this in common with his son, but over the last year or so, his son had ceased to show much interest in sports. He'd grown his hair long in a way Roman felt didn't suit him. His complexion had suffered. He spent more time watching television or in his room reading and listening to music. Though his grades were still good, he seemed lazy and discontent. But when Roman offered a helpful suggestion, his son became sullen and withdrew. Upon entering the kitchen, his son took the available seat beside Svirsky. "Hi, Pa," he said automatically. His presence at the table seemed to further unnerve Svirsky. "I really apologize," Svirsky said. "Leonia told me not to buy that car. He recommended another, but it was more expensive, and I felt uneasy borrowing more money from him. We'd already borrowed enough. I thought if I bought the cheaper car, it would be easier on Leonia and my sister. They've been very generous, but now I know it was a big mistake. I only managed to complicate things. We all make mistakes, Roman shrugged. His mood was brittle, and for some reason Svirsky's haplessness aggravated him. I'm very grateful to you for selling me the car, Svirsky said, and reached into his jacket pocket for an envelope. Roman watched him fumble with it and lay it on the table. It was stout with bills. I took out 3,000, like we agreed, Svirsky said. Okay, Roman said. With the envelope on the table, Svirsky appeared at a loss. Roman sat diagonally from him, but it seemed inappropriate to reach across the table. He expected Svirsky to pass it to him. Svirsky, for some inexplicable reason, continued to hesitate. You haven't seen the car yet, Roman said. We should go outside, and I'll show you the car. Yes, all right, Svirsky said, but he remained tentative. Roman pushed his chair back and got up. Svirsky, as if still hampered by something, slid his chair back slowly. I don't doubt you that the car is very good and worth the price, Svirsky said. I understand, Roman said, not quite understanding. But I'm not offended. It's every buyer's right to inspect his car. The thing is, Svirsky said, I took out $3,000 and I planned to give it to you, but I didn't anticipate the charge for the tow truck. So finally, there it was, Roman thought. How much was the tow truck? Roman asked. $150, Svirsky said penitently. Svirsky's implication was clear, and Roman looked around the table to see the reactions of his wife and son. His wife was circumspect, unwilling to provoke, but he could see that his son expected him to do the mean thing, the uncharitable thing. Why don't you go outside, Eddie? Roman said. Here are the keys. Take a look at the car. Give me a few minutes to think about it. Yes, of course, Svirsky said, and went to tie his boots. When Svirsky had gone, Roman looked again at his wife and son. Well, what do you say? Roman asked. What can I say? His wife replied. At $3,000, the car is a good price. Maybe we could get more, but for him, I didn't even put in the newspaper. It's hard not to pity him, his wife said. Roman didn't reply. He allowed for a quiet moment to prevail in which it was possible to consider and pity Svirsky. He wanted to show that he wasn't blind to the feeling. But as the moment extended, Roman believed it also allowed for a view of the complete picture. In the complete picture, Svirsky couldn't be considered alone. The complete picture also included themselves, their circumstances, their unpredictable future, and the persistent, unwieldy claims of the past. Roman rose from the table, went to the window, and saw Svirsky sitting motionless in the driver's seat. His hands were in his lap, and the engine was off, as if he didn't dare touch anything without permission. What's he doing? Roman's wife asked. Sitting, Roman said. It was easy to pity Svirsky, Roman thought. But for all his troubles, Svirsky was actually a lucky man. He possessed something Roman had lost and could never recover. Confused, tired, defeated, Svirsky would still go home to the expectant clamor of his young children. No money, no success, nothing the man attained would ever rival such joy. If he could, Roman would have traded places with Sviersky. He'd have done it in an instant, just to go back to the time when he could speak a word to his son without apprehension, to once more feel from his son a sincere, instinctive desire to be with him. He would do it just to relive the mornings when he drove his son to school in the same Volvo which he was now selling to Sviersky. He would do it for those 15 minutes when the boy sat buckled in the passenger seat, to see his small face with its compact intelligence a source of wonder and pride, and to watch him turn the radio dial and mouth the words to what seemed to Roman like one long, continuous song.
That was Paul Heck reading The Proposition by David Desmosdis. After a quick break, we'll hear a poignant tale of modern young people and the true meaning of love. You're listening to selected shorts recorded live in performance at Symphony Space in New York City and at other venues nationwide from PRI, Public Radio International. Welcome back to Selected Shorts, recorded live at Symphony Space in New York City. In our second story by McDowell Colony writer Francis Huang's The Modern Age, the worldly and sophisticated young urbanites are congenial and attractive people, but something inside seems to be missing. The reader of the story is Dawn Akemi Saito, and the story The Modern Age was introduced on stage by the Vietnamese-born writer Monique Quang.
When I think of McDowell, I think of snow. In 2005, I arrived there on a snowy afternoon in late February, and I left many weeks later on an early April morning with snow still thick in the ground. I think of how a covering of snow can make the world seem like a blank page. Not of how daunting a blank page can be for a writer, but of the possibilities. I'd come to McDowell to work on my second novel. Pages and pages full of doubts. Is this really a novel in progress, or a bloated short story that needs editing? Is this a novel, or perhaps just unforgivably trite? Is it time to go back to being a lawyer? The studio was a stone cottage with a red brick floor and a large fireplace that I could have roasted a small animal in. I spent hours watching from my windows small animals frolicking in the snow, but I did not attempt to hunt or roast any of them. And I worked on my second novel. For my first afternoon at McDowell, I wrote steadily. And occasionally, I even experienced those rare moments of wild joy and abandon that can come with the act of creating something new. It's a feeling that was akin to how I felt when I was 7 years old and first saw snow. The known world transformed, suddenly beautiful and playful, and acutely memorable. It is my great pleasure to introduce to you tonight The Modern Age, a short story by Francis Huang, who was a McDowell Fellow in 2003. The story is from her debut collection entitled Transparency. I've not had the pleasure of swapping McDowell's stories with Frances, so I can't tell you whether she was at McDowell in the wintry mix or the warmer months, but I can tell you that her writing is bracing, assured, sharply observed, and possessing a wit sharp as a knife. In fact, there is a curious aside about a knife in the modern age that piqued my interest when I first read it. The narrator, early on in the story, observes how one of the guests at a dinner party picks up a knife and is repeatedly turning it over on the tablecloth, pressing the blade against his thumb. After having read all the other finely crafted stories in her collection, I was left with the feeling that there was a knife present in all of them. If not in actuality, then certainly in intent and construction. Frances introduces us to characters whom we think we know. They're familiar and perhaps even quotidian at first glance. Then she allows us to see the capacity, the potential, even the promise for pain and tenderness. Each of her stories is in that sense a blade pressed against our thumb. Each of her stories is a blade worth turning over and over again. And now to read Frances Huang's The Modern Age is Don Akemi Saito. Thank you.
Last week, my friend Millie invited me to a latke party to celebrate Hanukkah. All of us sat around her table eating latkes with applesauce or sour cream, and Millie was telling me how to make them. You grate the potato as finely as possible, she said. It's from my mom's belief that the more effort you put in, the better it will taste. My mom likes to make cooking a hardship. Millie's friend Cornelius was fiddling with the knife that he had picked up from the table. The cunning shape of the blade bothered me, as if it had been designed for something more sinister than paring potatoes. He kept turning it over on the tablecloth, pressing the blade against his thumb. I had heard that as a child, he had undergone heart surgery to correct an arrhythmia. And now, his languid body and swollen hands suggested a slow, pulsing heart. Millie couldn't resist the morbid gleam of his mind. I had seen them sitting on a bench together in Rittenhouse Square, Cornelius speaking with his nose to the sky and his arms crossed over his chest, as Millie toyed with the edge of her coat. My friend had the plain, delicate beauty of a moth, a pale, uncanny face, and faded brown hair with a silver streak in front, though she was only 26 years old. Her loft apartment was whimsical and spare, a few glass objects lining the high windows. Cornelius gave the knife a lazy spin. Let's go around the table and tell each other persecuted ancestor stories. We looked at him in surprise, and he said, it should be easy. Everyone here is Chinese or Jewish. Now we looked at one another as if for the first time and laughed. I'll go first, Cornelius said, and he proceeded to tell us about his great uncle Frederick, who cut off his little toe to escape being drafted. I have a story like that, Millie said, only my grandfather was smarter. He put special drops in his eyes and flunked the eye test to avoid joining the Russian army. We went around the table, sharing stories we had heard from our families. Jennifer told us about her revolutionary grandmother, a spy for the Kuomintang, who was captured by the Japanese. Rachel told us about a second cousin of her mother's who was hidden by a Polish farmer underneath the floor of his barn. David told us about his grandfather who walked all the way from Nanjing to Shanghai to escape the communists. In some versions, he takes a train, but the official version is that he walks barefoot across the whole of China. David grinned and straightened his glasses. When he gets to Shanghai, he has no money left. The communists are on their way, and my grandfather is afraid he'll be executed because he's a member of the Kuomintang. He spends the night under a tree and dreams of a female ghost beneath the ground reaching up to grab him. He wakes up to take a piss, and his stream of urine is so strong it uncovers something shiny from the soil. My grandfather bends down to find a woman's gold ring. The next day, he exchanges it for a boat ride to Taiwan, and that's how he escaped the communists. David smiled at us again, clearing his throat. He was usually a quiet person, and that was the most any of us had heard him say in one evening. I told them about my mother's uncle, who was beaten and held for ransom by local bandits, hiding in the mountains near his village. He was released only when his family delivered a wood coffin filled with coins to his kidnappers. Cornelius raised his eyebrows. A coffin? I nodded. His family went bankrupt in order to save him, even though they thought he was a useless person. He was addicted to opium, but when he was released, he couldn't afford to smoke it anymore, and he became something like a servant to his younger brothers. Every morning, he walked my mother to school, and the two of them would search the ground for cigarette stubs. Then he would slit them open and collect the remaining tobacco to make a cigarette for himself. What happened to him? Millie asked. No one really knows. He refused to leave when the communists took over, and my family fled their village and lost track of him. Well, all of this makes me think how insignificant my own problems are, Millie said with a little smile. Here I am, complaining about how I don't have a boyfriend and hate my job, but I've never had to worry about anything, really. Like, I've never had to think about cutting my toe off. It just seems so absurd. Yet all these people had to struggle through so much adversity. And it had to do with when you were born and where you lived. I can't imagine it. It's easy to forget how lucky we are, I said. Where do you think our sadness comes from? Cornelius said. From owning too many things? From indigestion? He had picked up the knife again, and with the tip of it was tracing light circles on the back of his hand. A person whose struggle, whose suffering is created internally, well, it's just one's feelings, isn't it? One's depression? There isn't anything really to despair about. But even so, isn't that person's suffering real? I asked. Cornelius gazed at me with pity. There was something cruel about his regard. He believed he could do nothing for me. I experienced a similar hopelessness every morning when I opened up the newspaper, or when I watched a spider drown in my bathtub. Millie lit the menorah from left to right, and she, Cornelius, and Rachel sang a blessing in Hebrew with low voices. Their warbling was sweet to hear, and we smiled at each other like children who have entered a magic circle. I left Millie's party and walked along old narrow streets, feeling a peculiar tenderness as I passed by quaint 18th century homes with their soft-lighted windows. Inside, I imagine lit candles, roses in glass vases, gleaming mirrors, and bowls of potpourri smelling of cinnamon and pears. I imagine those warm rooms and wish more than anything to step inside. The cold was vivid against my skin. By the time I reached my boyfriend's apartment, I felt I was glowing. I tried to explain to him how interesting it had been going around the table at Millie's latke party, relating the terrible, miraculous things that had happened to our families. My boyfriend frowned. He is a serious person and wondered if we had told our stories in bad faith simply to amuse ourselves. When I described to him how Millie made latkes, my boyfriend, who is Jewish, finally cracked. That's not how my mother makes them. He has never liked Millie and thinks she is a cold person because she talks to a spot above his head without looking at him. My feelings for her are so different. I have a photograph of her standing under a huge magnolia tree, and she is wearing a blue dress and black Mary Jane shoes, and she looks just like Alice in Wonderland. Even if I show him this picture, my boyfriend will never see Millie as I do. Then we went to bed. I thought about Millie and Cornelius and how nothing will ever happen between them. Cornelius is self-absorbed and Millie, shy and repressed. Both of them are too afraid. But what is it that they are afraid of? As for my boyfriend and me, we had been together for over a year, yet not once had the word love been spoken between us. Our hearts seemed too small for such a word to pass between our lips. We had not encountered adversity and seemed fated to walk through life unattached, glancing at one another through distant windows.
Dawn Akemi Saito read Francis Huang's story, The Modern Age. All these writers introducing other writers to you readers. If you've enjoyed these stories, you might be interested in our CD collection, Readers and Writers. For all the details, go to selectedshorts.org. Selected Shorts is produced by Catherine Minton and directed by Isaiah Sheffer. The executive director of Symphony Space is Cynthia Elliott. Our radio producer is Sarah Montague, and our production assistant is Miranda Schaefer. The readings are recorded by Miles B. Smith, and our mix engineer is Stu Kennedy. Our theme music is Roger Calloway's Come to the Meadow. Major support for Selected Shorts is provided by Houghton Mifflin, publishers of The Best American Short Stories, edited in 2008 by Salman Rushdie, and by Barnes & Noble, bookseller since 1873, and on the web at bn.com. Additional support is provided by the Dungannon Foundation, sponsor of the Ray Award for the Short Story, Budget Travel, the National Endowment for the Arts, which believes that a great nation deserves great art, the New York State Council on the Arts, a state agency, the Henry Nias Foundation, and the Lila Acheson Wallace Theater Fund of the New York Community Trust. Selected Shorts is a co-production of Symphony Space and WNYC Radio in New York, and is distributed nationwide by PRI, Public Radio International.
Support for this program comes from this station and Public Radio International stations nationwide and is made possible in part by the PRI Program Fund, whose contributors include the Ford Foundation and the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation.
PRI, Public Radio International.
Hi, I'm Isaiah Sheffer. Greetings to our Selected Shorts podcast audience. If you've always wanted to be a selector of shorts yourself, here's your chance. On June 9, 2010, Selected Shorts at Symphony Space in New York will feature published stories selected by you, our audience nationwide. Go to selectedshorts.org/favorite to submit your story suggestions. Then, in the spring, you'll vote for your favorite of the final contenders.